From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. Imperialism in the West and the Rise of Capitalism in 19th Century Italy. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Marta Petrasevitz of Princeton University and Bernard Semmel of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. First on this edition of Soundings, a discussion with Marta Petrasevitz about her forthcoming study of 19th century Italian culture. Following that, a conversation with Bernard Semmel about his forthcoming book, The Idea of Imperialism. According to Marta Petrasevitz, the Calabrian latifundia, or large centralized estates of 19th century Italy, represent a transition from feudalism to capitalism, both economically and socially. But in their cultural organization, the latifundia retained many characteristics of the preceding Bourbon kingdoms. The estate of one Italian family, the Baroccos, is a case in point. Here is Marta Petrasevitz.
My central thesis is that this transitional period, which let's use the quotation mark around transition, because I'm not sure that it's really a transition. I think it is a system in itself. I think it's a viable system. I think the system, which is certainly unjust and certainly exploitative, but it's, so to speak, an indigenous system, which is a mixture of paternalism, of tradition, of various things that the reformers of the North didn't like and despised. It's something that Diderot, talking about Calabria, called the barbary. But it's something that the local people understood. It was the system which was based on their code of honor and shame, of their set of social and moral values. And therefore, the system, which is undoubtedly economically and socially unjust when you look from it at it from outside, proved to be extremely viable and very, very stable, and maybe altogether much better than what came afterwards, which was the immigration.
And how does the Baroccos family illustrate all of this? What, crystallize it for you somehow?
Baroccos were the largest landowners in Calabria in the 19th century. They were the richest family in the kingdom in the 19th century. They were among the richest families in Italy. In terms of family histories, of generations who enter in this paternalistic relationship, I'm looking both at the lords, the masters, and at the peasants. Speaking specifically about the Baroccos, yes, they do, I think they are representative of the changes which have occurred. As I said, they represent the possibilities of the new entrepreneurship in the South, when the land becomes marketable, something which was not true in the 18th century, where the feudal land was subject to entailment. When land becomes free and marketable, when the products of land can be marketed on, can be sold on big European markets, when transportation improves, so oil, wine, grain can be exported and sold abroad, as well as in Naples, as well as in northern Italy. When money becomes a more easily accessible commodity through institutions of credits, banks, and so on, Baroccos are the example of an old family who knows how to use these opportunities. At the same time, they remain, and in this sense, they are significant for me, they remain strictly tied to the traditional forms of the organization of the society. And that's not because they don't know how the capitalist society moves, but they simply, because they know. They know what's rational in their situation. They know that it's much more reasonable and much more rational not to introduce the machines, not to introduce the costly mechanization which would make the Calabrian peasants feel that they don't know anymore how to produce, they don't know anymore how to till the land. You know, when I suspect strongly that speaking about transition may be very wrong in more than this one case, more than the Italian history. Because the transition, historians who speak about transition always look post factum.
Mm-hmm. We're looking back.
We are looking back, and not only we are looking only back, but we think that there is some purpose in history. So there actually is that the point that we have reached now was the point towards which the history was leading.
And you don't think that way, Marta?
No. Uh-huh. No.
Why? History is what? Just some sort of random rambling river, therefore?
I think the case, the chance, plays an enormous part in history. Uh-huh. I think...
Isn't that a little depressing to talk about history that way when we remove from it notions of purpose and design?
On the contrary, I think it leaves much more room for the human action, for the human desires. In this, I simply do not agree with Marx, and I do not agree with many Marxists. So I am and I am not.
Marta, tell me, let's be really specific and anecdotal here for a moment. Tell me a couple of stories about the banditi. I know that this isn't necessarily central to your investigation into 19th century southern Italian history, but this makes for some great stories.
In a way, the story of what was called the brigandage in southern Italy is important for my investigation.
How is
because
that?
This is a form of, it's certainly a form of struggle. It's an enormous disorder, and it's an epidemic disorder. I mean, the Calabria and the South were known throughout the 19th century as the land of brigandage. The brigands are really outlaws. The law is after them. They have to live in the mountains. I mean, they come frequently to the villages. They come to visit their mothers. It's very important that they continue to behave as good village boys. Although they're out on the roads, they commit all kinds of crimes. Uh-huh. But they protect their village. They have to come they do come to church on Sunday.
Goodness.
If there are any children born to them in the mountains, they bring them down to the village to be baptized. I mean, all this... codes of behavior of the good village boys. But I think that the way that the making of a brigand that I mentioned before, these conflicts on the level of the local society with tax collectors, with the soldiers, with the new representatives of various new representatives of the state, the making of the brigand would then inform the behavior of the brigands during their brigands' activities.
Brigandage.
Yeah. So therefore, they will concentrate their actions on the state agents, on the surrogates of the state. Mm-hmm. And I think that was making them into the enemies of the state. And especially the new state, the unified Italian state, which felt very strongly about the need to establish its legitimacy, which it lacked. I mean, it was a conqueror state. It's the state of the North. They perceived correctly the brigandage as the enemy of the state. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they waged a war on the brigands, a terrible war. I mean, which lasted in the South from the early 60s, right after the conquest of the South, through 1872-73. And the brigands, of course, were defeated.
I mean, when did they die out completely?
The last brigands are still operate at the very end of the century, 1880s, 1890s. the last famous brigand is Mussolino. Who?
Not Mussolini. But
no. Mussolino. Mussolino. <All right. laughs> No. But I would say that the big brigandage, I mean, the brigandage which can be seen as the self-defense of the Southern society against the reformist state, against the state, is defeated in mid-1870s.
Mm-hmm. Marta Petrusevich, let's conclude our conversation. We've been talking about your forthcoming book on Italian history, 19th century Italian history. Let me be a little impertinent here. Why are you writing this book? You're writing for historians, I take it, but you're also writing, what, for a general audience? What kind of difference would you hope that a book like this would make? What are you saying that hasn't been said before?
The reason why I lived in Calabria, I moved to Calabria in 73 because I was interested in structures. I was interested in abstract topics. I was interested in the 19th century world market and the incorporation of the economic peripheries into the world, the developing the international division of labor into the world market. I was interested in these abstract topics. And then I moved to Calabria, and I think I understood something about a defeated society, and the society which was absolutely broken by the so-called progress brought from outside, the society which is corrupted by the mafia, by political corruption, by lack of hope, the society which was whose tradition, whose memory was interrupted by the immigration, the massive immigration. I mean, I think everybody in the United States who knows one or another Italian, I can bet that this Italian would be from Calabria or from Sicily. So I think I want to understand in which way it happened. I wanted to oppose the unidirectional interpretation of history. Mm-hmm. I want to oppose the idea that the progress necessitates breaking up of the traditional structures, and that the people from outside have a right to judge how local societies are organized, what's wrong, what's right. So I am, in a way, I'm trying to provoke a discussion. I am, in a way, defending an organization of a society which obviously is questionable, such as latifundismo, such as patriarchy, mm-hmm. such as crimes of honor. I mean, I'm defending the right to the existence of what's called the moral economy or the traditional society against our idea of progress.
Marta Petrusevich is a professor of history at Princeton University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Marta Petrusevich worked on a forthcoming study of Italian history, entitled The Rise and Fall of the Calabrian Latifundia. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a conversation featuring another scholar who recently completed a fellowship year at the center. Bernard Semmel teaches at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Bernard Semmel is the author of a forthcoming book entitled The Idea of Imperialism. Bernard Semmel, let's begin with one single, relatively simple question. How old is imperialism? How far back does that term go?
Well, not as far back as people might imagine. One, of course, thinks of Rome and the term imperium, which meant empire. But in fact, the word imperialism probably doesn't become current until the 1860s, when it's identified with the supporters of the empire of Napoleon III. in the 1870s, people speak of the imperialism of Disraeli's Tory party. In the 1880s, also in England, people are imperialists if they are interested in the federation of the British Empire, a drawing together the various colonies of Great Britain in a federation.
So it's a relatively recent term amongst what the historians and the political scientists. Has it always been a dirty word?
No. Certainly the imperialists who defended imperial federation thought of themselves as good guys. It was hardly a dirty word then. And indeed, even into the 20th century, people, Tories in England, who wished a system of imperial preference, called themselves imperialists, and liberals, who wanted a program of social reform, and thought they by effecting such a program, they would be breeding an imperial race, were happy to think of themselves as imperialists.
Do we always think of it, Bernard Semmel, in economic terms? Today we associate it with many negative cultural kinds of things. Help me to tease out that economic basis.
Yes, no. Actually, and this ties in very nicely with when imperialism became a dirty word. It was in the course of the Spanish-American War in America, the war between America and Spain in 1898, and the Boer War. At the turn of the century, between the Dutch republics of South Africa and, that is, the republics in South Africa, which were populated by people who originally came from Holland, and Great Britain. Then it became a dirty word. It was very much linked with economic imperialism. The notion was that capitalists had surplus funds they didn't know quite what to do with. They decided, therefore, to invest them in areas, underdeveloped areas, where the profits from such investment would be great. And when it came about that these funds were imperiled by native populations, the capitalists, according to J.A. Hobson, who developed this notion in a volume in 1901, then the capitalists called upon the mother country to send troops to defend their investments.
Help me to understand the difference. We're talking about imperialism as a dirty word, a pejorative kind of thing. Do we associate that with the greedy impulses of its practitioners? Do we figure out what imperialism means in terms of its consequences upon a society in which imperialism, in which it becomes a force?
That's rather an interesting question. In fact, those in the 19th century who thought that they ought to do something to modernize, to develop the less developed parts of the globe, thought themselves doing a good turn. Felt themselves operating under as benevolent actors on the international stage.
Sure, we're going to improve people. We're going to help them economically.
We're going to provide. Karl Marx. This is a good example of this. Karl Marx was entirely content with what today would be called British imperialism in India, because he saw the British investment in railroads as providing an economic substructure for a future development of India. He saw British, as one might think of it today, cultural imperialism, as undermining feudalism in India.
And that was a good thing for him.
That was an entirely good thing. Now, in the eyes of the left today, both these developments would be regarded as evil.
Well, this strikes me as something of a paradox, Bernard Semmel. Here you're telling me that Karl Marx, in your view, would approve of the British industrial presence, I guess we can call it, in India. That seems to run against our stereotypical notions. Help me to understand how imperialism itself has been misunderstood as a label. Surely that is part of what you're trying to figure out here.
Imperialism, quite early in the game, became a propaganda term used by the left, by the neo-Marxists, from Hilferdink and Kautsky to Lenin, mm-hmm. in the period before the First World War.
Mm-hmm. End of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century.
Exactly that. Is a way of displaying the inadequacies of capitalism, the evil tendencies of capitalism, the youthful aspects of imperialism, which Marx and Engels both spoke about at great length in their writings, were entirely forgotten. I don't mean to suggest that Marx was not critical of certain parts of the European imperial presence in the underdeveloped world, but on the whole, he thought that this was a necessary and progressive step.
Figure this one out for me, Bernard Simmel. We got the chicken and the egg. Does imperialism come first, followed by capitalism? Which of them gives rise to the other?
To the other.
Can you have an imperialism that isn't necessarily capitalistic?
Well, that, of course, is an interesting problem. And as far as the Marxists are concerned, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, imperialism is old as man.
Just the idea of one neighbor sort of imposing himself on another neighbor.
Men have always been aggressive and avaricious. Catholics speak of original sin, and it seems an adequate description of such a force. The fact that this natural inclination of man has been tied to an economic system by the Marxists, this is something quite new.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring this term imperialism more or less into the contemporary world. We have lots of, what would we call them, political factions, ideological groupings, mm-hmm. clusters, that use a term like imperialism for their own, propagandistic purposes. Right. I recall, for example, President Reagan giving a speech and calling the Russians an evil empire. Mm-hmm. Now that, again, sounds like a bit of a contradiction, because the Russians are not necessarily... Well, you help me to figure this out.
Well, yeah.
Imposing themselves?
I think this is an interesting affair. First of all, here we have... Russia has, for a considerable time, posed as, almost by definition, a non-imperialist power, an anti-imperialist power, simply because it has declared itself a socialist state, which is a bit ridiculous when you think of the fact that Russia has been the most successful imperialist country of the 20th century.
And when you say successful, you're not necessarily talking about... you are talking about imposing an economic system, but principally the imposition of a political system.
The Russian armies, on the basis of brute power, have taken over Eastern Europe. They're now in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
There are Russian advisors in Ethiopia.
Right.
The Russians managed to escort Cuban troops to Angola.
Uh-huh.
If this isn't imperialism, what is?
But on the other hand, the Russians would look at the United States of America and say, hey, you guys are doing the same thing in Latin America. So here again, we have this tangle of figuring out how people use the term imperialism.
It does become a bit of a tangle. And let me give you an instance of this. During the various World War II conferences among the big three, Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill, Roosevelt, an American, thinking of himself as anti-imperialist and America as an anti-colonialist power, saw Churchill as the spokesman for imperialism, and Russia as very much like himself, an anti-imperialist power.
Hmm.
In the process of misunderstanding the nature of Russian geopolitics, he made more possible than would otherwise be the case the expansion of Russian power. Karl Marx, to return to Karl Marx, and Friedrich Engels in the 19th century, saw the chief danger to world peace in an expansionist feudal Russia. Marx and Engels as late as 1890, attributed this Russian imperial drive, aggressive drive, to her history and her geographical position. It might be argued that were they alive today, Marx and Engels, they would see Stalin's Russia as very much in the pattern of the Russia of the Tsars, forced onto an aggressive and imperial design by the pre-Soviet history,
Quick footnote to our conversation, Bernard Semmel. What, judging from your study of imperialism, can we expect anything new over the next couple of hundred years? Are we simply going to watch things unfold at random? What directions might this notion, this movement, this idea take?
That's an interesting question. I don't believe we're going to eradicate these human inclinations toward aggression and toward avarice. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, if we can succeed in somewhat masking these inclinations through competition, particularly if such competition is expressed in a formal system of political freedom, we have a good chance of avoiding war. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, we find that we allow the brutal impulses, the primitive impulses that have always been present in men, to achieve political expression, as they have in the century, in the Nazi regime, in Stalin's regime, then we have a very painful situation. This becomes a particularly painful one when we realize that even if the brutal powers may be culturally and politically backward, they nonetheless have rather advanced industrial machines and very highly developed military machines. There could be a calamity.
Bernard Semmel is a professor of history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Bernard Semmel worked on a forthcoming book entitled The Idea of Imperialism. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on 19th century Italian history and on imperialism, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion of the ratification of the United States Constitution, another in a series of programs on the bicentennial of the American Constitution. My guests will be Michael Lenish of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Michael Gillespie of Duke University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Imperialism in the West and the Rise of Capitalism in 19th Century Italy. Listen for some answers and insights this week on Soundings. Marta Petrasevitz of Princeton University discusses her book on the Italian latifundia, or centralized estates, and Bernard Semmel of the State University of New York talks about his book on the idea of imperialism, The Latifundia and the Imperial, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.